down the road, you'd be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than the ones you did. So dream, explore, say yes to life. Be inspired to live life as an exciting adventure of discovery. You are listening to the Inspire Possibility Show, and I'm your host, Mark Susnell. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining me in the Inspire Possibility Show. And every week we invite various people I consider cutting-edge thought leaders, people that are saving lives, that are by inspiring us and sometimes healing us. And I've had several people like that. And, you know, in the world today, there it seems like when we're in the area of illness, the two main areas that people talk about, the two main diseases are heart disease and cancer, and so it just seems that this month I've invited people who are experts in this field. Last week I had Dr. Dean Ornish, who wrote about reversing heart disease, and I have today Dr. Stephen Gurley, who is an oncologist. He saved many lives. He's the author of In My Hands. And it's really about a lot about the impact that cancer has on loved ones and the doctors themselves. And what's interesting, what I really liked about Dr. Gurley was that each chapter's book, is each chapter has a focus, and it really looks at a particular question. And so he's chief of staff of oncology. He's from Tyler, Texas, and he's at Christus Trinity Mother Francis Hospital. And rather than me to go on about his work and all the challenges and opportunities, and I know that he also feels very blessed to have the life he does with working with people at this critical phase of their life. So welcome, Dr. Stephen Gurley, author of In My Hands, to the Inspire Possibility Show.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me and for having me. An honor and a pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you very much. And as I said off air, it seems like your hands are very full with the work you do. And what is kind of interesting is that something your publicist said was that in 1971, Richard Nixon declared the war against cancer, and yet here it is, what, 50 years later almost, and have we really made much progress, do you think?
In some diseases, we've made incredible progress, and I call cancer a set of diseases because cancer in the colon acts very different than cancer in the breast or cancer in the pancreas or other organs. With some cancers, we've made remarkable progress in that almost 50 years. Breast cancer, colon cancer, some of the leukemias, some of the lymphomas. In others, I'm sorry to say, we're not doing much better now than we were doing in 1971. Pancreas cancer is one example. Primary liver cancer, also called hepatocellular cancer, is another example, where the majority of patients diagnosed with those diseases still die within a matter of months or a few years of those diseases. We've improved their survival by a few months in some cases, but we certainly haven't increased cure rates.
And I noticed that is your specialty, and I'm just curious why you made that your specialty, dealing with pancreatic and liver patients.
Well, as a surgeon, I frankly have the best chance of curing patients with those diseases. Chemotherapy for the cancers in those organs doesn't tend to do much in terms of curing people. It, again, may prolong their survival a bit. But when I can surgically remove a cancer in the pancreas or tumor or tumors in the liver, then there is a chance. You know, a percentage of those patients do survive long term. And I've always been interested in sort of difficult and challenging diseases and ones where we can make a major impact. And that's why I've chosen to do research in those areas. That's why I've chosen to take care of patients with those sorts of diseases, because there's so much room for improvement and so much need for more aggressive understanding of how we can help these patients.
Wow. You know, I want to read something that Dr. David Hoyt wrote. He's an MD. He's the executive director of the American College of Surgeons. And he wrote, "Every so often a book enlightens the basis upon which we serve each other as humans, professionals, and as surgeons." Dr. Gurley's sharing of many patient stories, each with a message for living life, is a testament to the human spirit of how we confront our mortality and the grace of our species. You will be inspired by reading this wonderful book. As a patient, a surgeon, any medical professional, or anyone alive. What a profound statement.
Yeah, it was an honor that Dr. Hoyt wrote that very wonderful review for me. I was blessed to have a number of senior surgeons throughout American surgery review the book before it was actually published, and write very kind remarks. And I think it points out the importance of the humanity of what we do as surgeons and as physicians. Things have become so technologically advanced that one of the reasons I wrote this, to remember and maintain the focus on the importance of empathy and the importance of human connection in caring for our patients, rather than worrying about, you know, what the latest technical advance is, or filling out our medical records and some of the things that take up far too much of our time.
So what I was, from reading the materials about you that your publicist said, it sounds like what you're suggesting is that the cancer surgeon really also needs to be like a family doctor, have that empathy, that compassion. Is that accurate?
That's absolutely correct, because as a surgical oncologist, you know, many surgeons, if they see a patient, let's say you have problems with gallstones, they'll see you and then they'll schedule an operation and take out your gallbladder and then see you back once in their office. And it's like, okay, you're doing great, have a good life, and off you go. You know, you're out of their life, they're out of your life, and you're taken care of. With cancer, because it can come back despite our best efforts, despite doing a good operation where we believe we've removed all the cancer, the problem is there can be malignant cells hiding somewhere that we simply can't detect. So I follow my patients for life. I've got patients I've followed for more than 25 years now. And so I do get to know them, and they get to know me. And I ask them about their family. How are their kids? How are their grandkids? How are their pets? Show me pictures from your latest vacation. They've watched my kids grow up. They know I coached soccer teams for many years, so they used to ask me how my teams were doing. And so you develop a very personal, deeper relationship that is much more meaningful than just, I need to go to the doctor to get this problem taken care of. Okay, it's good. Thanks, doc. See you. Bye. You know, this is a lifelong relationship I develop with these patients.
I don't think a lot, you know, it's interesting you said that, because I don't think a lot of people realize that it's so off, especially with a surgeon, because it's the surgeon sometimes does the surgery and then he turns you back over to the treating oncologist or if it's, you know, heart disease, to the cardiologist.
That many surgical oncologists have that identity that we do follow our patients for long term, and we work together as teams. You know, you mentioned the medical oncologists or radiation oncologists. You know, they may see the patient as well, but you know, the patients like to know that there's a team of people watching after them, that, you know, there's many eyes on what's going on with them, and that, you know, we're all very interested and engaged in making sure that they're getting the best outcome possible.
So talk to us about the highs and the lows of being a cancer surgeon.
Well, the highs are when you get a patient who has a difficult situation or it's a technically demanding operation and you're able to perform it successfully and the patient does well. And then, the follow-on to that is when you get to see that patient, when it's one of those patients who is a success story, who you get to see 5 and 10 or 20 years later. I've had patients come to me and say, I've been told I've got 6 months to live, and I'm able to do an operation, and then with my colleagues, we give them additional treatments, and I've got some of those patients who are now 20-year survivors. And the notes and letters you get from those people, and ultimately from their families. I got a beautiful Christmas card last year from the granddaughter of a patient who had been told you have 6 months to live. She was not yet born. Her mother was pregnant with her, and she wrote me a letter to say, thank you, because of you, my grandfather was at my high school graduation.
Wow.
I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to get a letter like that. Conversely, the lows are when you tell a patient, look, I'm going to go in and I plan to do this operation, and you get in and find, oh, my gosh, the cancer has spread. There's tumor nodules that we couldn't detect on our CT or MR scans, or you do an operation and it goes well, but then you see the patient back 6 months or 12 months later, whatever it is, and their cancer has come back. You see new tumor nodules on the scan. Those are always very painful conversations to have. And even though patients and their families have been prepped and we tell them, look, I can't guarantee your cancer won't come back and we're going to have to watch you, it's still always a very, very hard and emotionally charged conversation to have when you have to go in and drop that bad news bomb and say, I'm really sorry, your cancer's back and here's what we're seeing, but here's what we can do. But, and it depends. Sometimes there's still things you can do, and other times you have to be very honest and say, I don't think we're going to be able to cure you of this, but we're going to see if we can buy you some time. And those are just rough conversations to have, and it's emotionally draining on everybody. Obviously, patient and family most, but the care team also is very much affected by those kinds of problems.
So what I'm wondering about is so you have these lows. How do you deal with it? What's your strategy? I mean, you go home, and how do you handle that?
For about two decades, I coached youth soccer teams, both my older son and my daughter's teams. I also refereed soccer matches, so I would sometimes come into work, at 4 or 5 in the morning, so I could get my work done by 5 in the afternoon, so I could go out and coach, and then on the weekends, obviously coach games or referee games. So the short answer is I exercise. For me, exercise is critical. It's a way to burn off angst and energy. So I like to bicycle. I like to ride my horse. I like to go to the gym and work out. That's important for my mental health. Burning some calories and blowing off some steam through a good hard exercise session is a great way for me to kind of stay balanced.
Wow! So do you do that every day?
I try to. I wish I could say I achieve that every day.
That would not be true.
There are some days where it's a long day and I don't get home until 8 or 8:30 at night. I'm pretty much, again, to use a horse riding expression, rode hard and put up wet. And in that case, I just want to come home and have dinner and sit on the couch with my wife and relax and talk to her for 30 minutes. And, that also helps. I'm blessed to have a wife who is very understanding and knows what I go through. And she having conversations with her also is a great help to me.
Yeah, I mean, I would just think it'd be so heartrending to go through that and to lose somebody. When you open up to these patients and then you lose them and have to tell them that news, it just must be horrible.
Yeah, no, they're very difficult conversations, and I do connect emotionally with my patients, which is a risk, obviously, because patients with cancer die. They can, despite our best efforts, they can have their disease recur. They can develop tumors that you never expected. I've had patients who survived one cancer go on to develop a second type of cancer and ultimately succumb to that. That's very frustrating to see those sorts of things happening. But I think the thing that is critical from my point of view is I always have decided that if I stop feeling, if I stop having that connection, I need to stop doing what I'm doing. It just means I'm no longer have the level of involvement and engagement with my patients that I personally find necessary. I know there are oncologists or surgeons or other doctors who the way they deal with it is they put up a heavy shield around them. They have a heavy facade that you just can't get through, and they don't seem to feel much. And that's, I'm not in any way denigrating that. If that's the way they have to deal with it, I understand. Dealing with patients who have potentially lethal diseases or who you know are dying of their disease is a tough thing to do. And as a caregiver and as a physician, we have to have some effective mechanism and method to deal with that angst and with that pain that comes with watching people who are dying. So, I don't know that there's any one technique to deal with it best, but, that's how I handle it personally.
Well, I think on a bigger scale, it's a lot of people are, who, let's say in the everyday world, are just kind of afraid to really open themselves up and be vulnerable for that fear of being rejected or the pain they're going to feel afterwards. And it's just in everyday living, and here you are in this life or death actual situation. One of the chapters, what I like are some of the titles in your book about just one of them that I kind of saw that this one of the chapters called It's Not Fair. And it's so often that's such a common refrain that people say it's could be revolving anything. It's not fair. And tell me about that chapter.
Well, that chapter, it's interesting you mentioned that one. I opened that talking about my days as coaching soccer teams and how my boys on my team would learn to not come out and say, oh, it's not fair, coach, I got called for a foul, or that kid fouled me and didn't get a card, and I'd give them a stern look and say, no, life is not fair. None of us gets a contract that says it is. And the story is really about the fact that I hear that phrase frequently from patients. I live right. I don't smoke. I don't. I exercise. I eat a good diet. How can I get cancer? It's not fair. And you look at them and you go, you're right. It's not fair. It's not right. There's no good explanation for it. And I'm sorry you're dealing with this, but let's just work through this and deal with what you've got and come up with a good way to do it. And I tell the story specifically of a woman who was very young when she was diagnosed with colon cancer, and it had metastasized to the liver, so we had to take out the colon tumor, and I ultimately ended up taking out her liver metastases. And during the middle of all of that, her husband just decided he couldn't deal with the emotional baggage of a wife who he thought might die of cancer. So to everyone's incredulity, he left her. And
Wow. She
came in tearfully one day and said, that's just not fair. And I said, no, that's beyond not fair. That just absolutely stinks. That's rotten. That's awful. She ultimately, did well. She got her life back together. She moved to a new city. She moved closer to where her children lived. She was enjoying that. She started a new career. And she, was about 7-8 years out from her diagnosis of colon cancer when I got a call, and she was sobbing, and I said, my gosh, what's wrong? And she said, I was just diagnosed with advanced breast cancer.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, talk about a cold, hard slap in the face. I mean, that's and it was the same thing. And she said, why is this happening to me? And I said, I don't have an answer for that question. And it was the same conversation. It's not fair. Why is this happening? What can I do to prevent this? And, there are some things we just don't have answers for. But, that's really sort of the point of the chapter, that none of us has given a promise that there's going to be fairness in life. And some people do get tough breaks and get a bad hand dealt to them. And this woman was an example of that. But she's also an example, she's still alive. She's still fighting. She's still doing everything she can to treat this new cancer and to carry on with her life. So it's also a tale of my admiration for her resilience and her spirit.
Well, what your book has been advertised as, promoted as, is that each chapter has these poignant stories from your own experience about some of your patients. And in chapter 26 is called The Million Dollar Man. Can you tell us about that story?
Well, that's a story about honor, integrity, and humor. You know, so you think being a cancer surgeon, there's not much humor in that, but there's a couple of the chapters, I've actually had people call me and say, you know, I don't know what to make of your book. You know, one chapter I'm laughing, and then the next chapter I'm crying. And I said, well, welcome to life. That's the reality of what we deal with in cancer and in life in general. So there's some stories in there that have some humorous component. And then this guy was, you know, he came in, he had his wife and daughters with him, and he had colon cancer that had spread to his liver. And he was very jocular, very happy-go-lucky kind of guy. And he said, well, doc, do you think you can help me? And I had looked at his scans, so I said, yeah, I think I can do an operation to remove these tumors. And he turned to his wife and daughters and said, well, there you go. You're not going to get your $1 million. And they protested loudly, and I said, what's with the $1 million? He said, oh, I have a $1 million life insurance policy. I'm just letting them know they're not going to get it yet. And this became sort of a running theme every time we visited. So I was able to do an operation, remove his tumors. He did well for several years. Now, the interesting thing is, while he was in the hospital after his liver operation, I sat with him one day, and his wife and daughters weren't there. And I said, you know, what do you do? And he goes, well, I'm a pilot. And I said, oh, yeah. And he turns out he flew, you know, jets for a big airline. And I said, where'd you learn to fly? And then goes on to tell me, well, I'm a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy, and I flew F-4 Phantoms in Vietnam. I was like, wow. You know, and the least thing I'd expected, I said, well, what was that like? And, you know, he described, you know, landing and taking off from a carrier. And again, you know, he's all sort of happy-go-lucky. I said, well, were you ever involved in any air-to-air combat? Then he became very somber. And he said, yeah, I have 2 combat kills. And I quickly realized, okay, that's, boy, talk about an emotionally charged topic. And he goes, it's not something I talk a lot about, doc, because, you know, I lost friends and comrades up there. And I said, I got you. So a few years went by, and I knew I was going to be visiting the city where this man lived. And he'd always said, you know, if you're ever up there, call me, and I'll take you to our training facility. So I called him. Well, it turned out this guy was actually the pilot in charge of training for pilots for that particular airline. And he took me and he strapped me in with him to a 737 simulator. And he said, okay, doc, I'm going to show you how we do this. And so we take off. And, you know, this thing is on big hydraulic struts. You know, it feels like you're taking off. And he let me make a few kind of banking maneuvers. And then he showed me how they would, you know, make sure that pilots came in for a smooth landing. And so it was amazing. It was a remarkable experience. And he said, well, wait just a minute, doc. And he got up and left. And you know, he literally told me, he said, make sure you strap into your seat. You know, we make this very realistic. Well, all of a sudden, you know, the cockpit goes dark. This thing starts bucking like a Bronco. And he said, his voice comes over the speaker. He said, your pilot just died of a myocardial infarction. You had mentioned heart disease earlier. And I said, okay. And he said, you're landing alone in a bad rainstorm at night. Good luck. Well, all of a sudden, this thing is bucking, and I'm holding on to it. And I, you know, in my mind, I know it's a simulator, but it's all seeming very real. And there's this very calm female voice going, your angle of approach is too low. Pull up. And I'm going, oh, my God. And, you know, so I, you know, over the next 3 minutes, I fought with this thing and managed to bring it in for a landing. I have to admit, I ran off the runway. And his voice and the voice of several of
them. But we won't tell it. We won't tell anybody. We won't
tell
anybody.
Yeah, they were laughing.
I'll delete
said,
it from the show.
What do you think
I'll
of that?
The
yeah, there you go. Well, it was hilarious. I mean, I was sweating profusely, and he opened the door to this thing and said, "That's payback, doc, for that operation you did." I said, "Thanks a lot, buddy." He goes, "Yeah, you're kind of sweaty," and I said, "Yeah, I am a little sweaty. That's quite an experience." I said, "If you're putting guys through this all the time, that's crazy." But yeah, that's the kind of stuff that he did. You know, it was his job to make sure that the pilots were ready for any eventuality. And interesting insight for me to see what those guys go through to train and to stay up to date on you know, being safe.
Wow. So, I always ask my guests a few questions, and what inspires you right now?
Oh, what inspires me is my children. I now have two grandchildren. That's a blessing, going to visit them. My son lives in Phoenix, Arizona area now, so I get out to see them as often as I can. Seeing the next generation is always a gift. Building a new program. I've recently just moved to a new program where I'm being asked to build a new oncology center, and that's exciting. That's inspiring. I've got two
And where's
younger
that going to be?
daughters, and yeah,
Where's
that's
that
here
going to
in
be in the
Tyler.
world?
I was in Houston, Texas for the last 30 years, and I just moved here to the Tyler area about 2 months ago. So this is a new position for me and a new place, and so getting to help new patients and work with new group of people who are very committed to building a world-class center for me is a lot of fun. So that's very inspirational.
What's right now, or would you say, is your biggest challenge?
Biggest challenge right now, I think, that we all face in medicine is the fact that medicine has changed so radically. One of the big topics that you can't go to any medical meeting these days without hearing some talk or seeing some presentation on burnout of caregivers. And we talked earlier about sort of the emotional toll
Right.
that comes from taking care of cancer patients. But there's another toll, which is just the fact that there's so much administration, so much electronic medical record requirements, so many hours in our day that get spent on non-patient care issues. And I don't know a single doctor who didn't go into medicine because he wanted to fill out more paperwork. He or she did it because they wanted to take care of people. They wanted to connect to people.
Right.
But we find that more and more of our time is being, requested or required, demanded even, for these non-patient care issues. And it's a source of great frustration, and it's a problem that I know people are looking at addressing.
Well, the burnout in everything in life. So what about this idea of burnout? I mean, are there any suggestions you might have to people about burnout?
Yeah, balance. I've seen, again, when you enter the career in medicine, it's not a 9-to-5 job. You're going to keep odd hours.
Right.
You're going to have to go in nights and
Sure.
weekends sometime. But I always taught my younger colleagues, make sure you spend time with your family. That's why I coached soccer teams for many years. I made the commitment to do that, and that meant I had to get up real early in the morning and go in and make sure I get all my work done and saw my patients and did my operations, did my research, et cetera, et cetera. But I also then made sure I got out in time that I could go spend time with my family. And I'll never forget, in my first year after I had finally finished my training, a very famous American surgeon came as a visiting professor. And at the time, my children were very small, so I had crayon art on the wall in my office. And he came in, and the first words out of his mouth was, "I wish I'd have spent more time with my kids when they were young." And I thought, what a sad thing to say. I don't ever want to say that. I don't ever want to
I
look
know.
back and thought, oh my gosh, I missed time with my own kids. And so, yeah, I sometimes would work odd hours, or I'd make sure I went home and spent time with them, and then if I had to go back into work, I would do it. But I always made sure, even if it was a sacrifice or meant more time on the road for me, that I did that because I never wanted to be that guy. I did not want to think, gosh, 30 years from now, I don't ever want to be that guy who's at the end of his career saying, gee, I don't know my own family. That's a sad thing.
It is. It is, definitely. I want to remind our audience that I'm interviewing Dr. Stephen Gurley. He wrote a book called In My Hands. He's been sharing his story with us and some of the people that he's treated. And you can get a copy of this book on Amazon. And are there other places they can get the book, Dr. Gurley?
I think it's also at Barnes & Noble,
Barnes and Noble.
barnesandnoble.com. I think sort of the usual booksellers, the usual suspects,
Right.
so to speak.
Yes, I know the drill. Well, thank you so much for being our guest. You've been an inspiration. I commend you for your dedication. I come from a family of medical doctors. So I had two uncles who were medical doctors, and I know the commitment, and there is a sacrifice in terms of what you have to give, and of course you get a lot back, but it's this old thing of making find the balance, which is the challenge for everybody. So thanks again, Dr. Stephen Gurley, for being on the Inspire Possibility Show, and to you all out there, join us next week. In the meantime, journey on.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I hope you feel inspired to take the next step in your life. And if you haven't already, please take the time to visit my website at inspirepossibility.com and discover the various services and products we offer that could just very well change your life.